Steve Ratten is a world leader in agroecology, biological control of pests, and keeping bees healthy. He is Professor of Ecology at Lincoln University, and he's with me now. Hello, Steve.
Yeah, morning, Kim.
How are you?
I'm a bit cold, actually. I'm sitting in a sleep out with no heating just to keep the dog away.
That does what? That doesn't sound very healthy, Steve. Couldn't you get a blankie? You wrapped up in a blankie?
No, I will in a minute. I'll put a bit of newspaper over my legs.
You're sounding a bit warm.
No, I've just got hay fever, which I'm doing my best to not to sneeze while I talk to you.
Good Lord. Hay fever seems a positive disadvantage in somebody who's concerned with bees and the great outdoors.
That's a good point. Pollen everywhere, but the bees are declining in number now, as you know, so it's not too bad.
What is the state of bees, then? Are they continuing to decline, or have they plateaued?
All over the world they're declining, actually. Here, ironically, there are more honeybee hives than they've ever been before, but I think they're not doing too well because there's a little mite, M-I-T-E, that infests them.
Is that the varroa mite?
Yeah, varroa, exactly.
I thought we'd come to terms with that. I thought that we were dealing with it, cohabiting with it.
I think what growers do is they put pesticides on the landing platform, which I'm not complaining about, but I think at least one of those has led to the bees being resistant, so it's not a long-term policy, I don't think.
It's honeybees that mainly we're talking about in this conversation, is it? What about the indigenous bees?
The ones we're working on are honeybees, that's true. But when we do experiments, bumblebees join the party as well, so we're looking at them. Native bees, I think we have 20 to 30 species that live only here. But in agricultural land, you don't see very many, unfortunately. Honeybees dominate, so we're sticking with honeybees at the moment.
All right. I just wonder whether we didn't see them because they're really tiny.
With what, sorry?
They're really tiny. I wonder whether we didn't see them or weren't visible.
Well, that's true, actually. Most people would see them on flowers in their garden, on weeds, and they wouldn't probably notice them, certainly not name them.
Yeah.
I think they're more abundant in more natural habitats, actually, so it's part of the story of biodiversity loss, really.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, we're talking about honeybees. What do they like to eat?
Well, everybody knows, from kids upwards, you know, buzzy bees and all that, know that bees land on flowers. That's been known. So I think Aristotle was the first person who worked on bees in that respect. So everybody knows that. But unfortunately, there are many plants in our gardens and agriculture that aren't much good for these animals because although they take pollen usually, we now know that the quality of the pollen is vital. For example, sodium needs to be quite at a high level in pollen, but many plants have a low level of sodium. So there's a good example why just because something pretty is in your garden doesn't mean the bees like it.
You are a gardener yourself, and I remember a little while ago you were recommending that phacelia was really good, tansy leaf. Is that the same thing, phacelia and tansy leaf?
Yeah, phacelia is a little plant, an annual that comes from California. And it is fantastic for bees. It's also fantastic for other beneficial insects like ladybirds. But when we see bees on it, we had an experiment some years ago where some poor student counted 23,000 something-something bees on phacelia, and just six of them took the pollen, only six, and all the rest took nectar. So that tells us that, pretty as it may be, there's something funny about its pollen, and we reckon it's low in sodium and other key minerals, and that's that applies to many plants in the garden and in the agriculture. They're pretty, but looks like honeybees don't like the pollen very much, and that's completely new information, actually.
And they don't like the pollen very much because the pollen doesn't give them what they need?
Yeah, it's got the wrong mixture of minerals, actually.
But they like the nectar.
They like the nectar, which doesn't differ much between plant species or plant families, but the pollen does differ. And if sodium is low, and other things like potassium and even copper and zinc are important for bees, and if they're low, the bees don't touch it.
And this is new information based on your special spectrometer, which detects trace minerals in pollen?
Yeah, we send all our pollen samples after experiments to University of Waikato, and they've got a machine with a name so long I can't even pronounce it, and it can find micro levels of nutrients in anything we send, and they tell us what's in the pollens that we send to them. Just recently we've sent sunflower pollen, oilseed rape, which is canola, and maize pollen. And although maize pollen is blown by the wind and is not insect pollinated, bees still take it. So that University of Waikato is looking at the minerals in those three plant species for us.
All right, so you haven't got the results of those yet?
No, because everybody's at home, aren't they, at the moment, like I am, and you probably.
Yes, well, no. I'm sitting in my pyjamas at work.
Yes, I heard that about 9 o'clock. I thought it was remarkable.
It's a gesture of solidarity. So bees know what they need. Do you think that one of the problems is too many honeybees and too few plants?
We're trying to help beekeepers, so I'm certainly not here to knock them, but I think at the moment people are worried that the hives are too close together and they're competing quite a lot for what pollen and nectar there is. And if a honeybee travels too far, then she burns up the sugar she's collected on the journey back, which seems a bit stupid. So there's obviously a limit to how far they should go. So in a low biodiversity farmland environment, these animals are working so hard and they're burning up their rewards, you could say.
Do you think that there should be some kind of legislation to make sure that there aren't too many hives in one place?
Well, I'll tell you what, naively, I would send packets of seeds to beekeepers, and that packet would contain Phacelia for the nectar, and one or two other plant species we could put in the packet, and they could then get decent pollen too, and that would be cheap as chips, but we're actually moving towards designing a reward for bees, and maybe in a few months we'll have an answer for what goes in that packet.
So you would still plant Phacelia even though its pollen is substandard?
Yes, I would, because it provides ample nectar and honeybees go mad for it, but I wouldn't plant it alone. I'd add some other things where we know the pollen's very good.
Why don't you just plant things with both nectar and pollen up to a higher standard? Is that possible, or can you only ever have one or the other?
There are some plants around, I'm sure, that can provide both, but I think there's 20,000 species of flowering plants in the world, so it's a big ask. But we're actually making mixtures now of minerals and sugar, and we think we've got nearly got the right mixture to put the mixture in front of the beehive rather than living plants, and that could be rather clever, and that could be used by beekeepers throughout the country and beyond.
That's a good idea. The history of bees in this country is pretty interesting, isn't it? The early European settlers realised that the tongues of the native bees were too short to pollinate the lucerne and the clover, so they had to import other varieties.
Precisely. It's actually not just the native bees, but honeybees have short tongues, and when the settlers arrived, they grew lucerne, of course, and red clover, and honeybees don't pollinate either of those. So they brought in bumblebees, looking for the long-tongued one, but they brought in four types of bumblebee because they couldn't tell the difference. So now there are four species of bumblebee in New Zealand, two very rare, but two in our gardens, and one of those, the long-tongued one, really can feed on plants where the nectar is very deep down in the corolla. So they brought the right one in, but with three others they didn't want.
Somebody has asked me a question for you, and it goes back to the native bees, that some of them are compromised by the honeybee. Is there a way our native bees can live harmoniously with the honeybee with our help?
I think the main thing restricting these animals, these natives, is that they're called solitary bees, but it's rather stupid because they nest in colonies. So what it means is the female native bee makes a hole in ideally a sandy bank, and she looks after her own babies in the nest down the bottom of that hole. But they're called solitary for that reason, but of course they forage together. And there is evidence that honeybees will just compete the bee off the flower. What can you do about that? I have a great difficulty in working out what to do about that, actually. But you can make artificial nests for these animals containing lots and lots of holes, and each hole will be occupied by one queen. So that way, we might push up their numbers, but once we're out in the field, I wouldn't have a clue what to do, I'm sorry to say.
And do you have artificial nests in your garden?
I don't actually, but we do on aspects of Lincoln University campus, parts of the campus, where these native bees are exploiting the little, it's like a lot of drinking straws held horizontally, really, inside a wooden case, and that seems to work okay.
It's not just bees that pollinate.
We've got this flipping cocker spaniel.
You what?
Which is one reason why I'm sitting in this dark, damp sleep out, because I don't want the damn dog in here. You'd never hear a word I say.
Oh. How did you suddenly introduce the spaniel into this conversation?
Because I'm talking to you in this dark, damp sleep out, and the stupid dog was scratching on the glass. And
oh, I didn't hear the scratching. I'm sorry. I thought
I
you
didn't
just...
say that bit. But also, if we had bee colonies, if we had bee colonies in the garden, the stupid dog would claw at them.
No, yeah. I completely understand. The
if
dog.
You know what cocker spaniels are like? They never sit still.
I do. I know what cocker spaniels are like. You'll have to take it for a walk as soon as you finish talking to us.
Yes, it doesn't help any. It doesn't help a great deal. She's too lively. We'll have to give her an aspirin or something.
Have you got an internal staircase?
Has what? Sorry, have you? Our house.
In your house, have you got an internal...
No, we live in a 1935 wooden house that was shipped out from Christchurch on a truck, so it's all one level.
All right.
Do you think we should put the dog upstairs or something?
Well, I have an internal staircase, and when it's very wet, as it is today, when I can't be bothered getting out of my pyjamas, which is most days, I sit in the kitchen and throw the ball so that it bounces down the hall and down the stairs.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, just a handy tip.
No, we're all on one level, unfortunately, so the dog just gets pushed outside so we can actually have a meal without having the dog jumping up at the table.
I hear that the SPCA is plumb out of dogs and cats as everybody's decided that they need a companion animal in the lockdown.
Well, it's quite likely, but this one's too companionable. They should damn well sit still now and again, but we should obviously trained it badly.
Look, I think there are people out there, Steve, that would be very grateful for your cocker spaniel if you should wish to put it up on Trade Me. Yes.
No, we love it.
You love it. Very well.
We should have trained the stupid thing better, shouldn't we?
What are you doing in your garden to increase the number of bees around for the pollination purposes?
I'll tell you what we do. I don't pull up many weeds. One thing we've got in the same family as Cecilia is borage, the real borage.
What's the not real borage?
Well, what I mean is, they're both in the borage family, but this one is called borage and the other one's called Cecilia. And honeybees and bumblebees go absolutely mad on it. And I'm going to collect some pollen from it and see if it's better than Cecilia.
Are you telling me that borage...
to drop their seeds and it comes up every spring.
Are you telling me that borage and Phacelia are pretty much the same-ish?
Same family, but the floral structure is a bit different. But honeybees and bumblebees go mad on borage.
Yeah, they do.
I've not seen them taking pollen, so that may not be the solution. But basically, I leave weeds around, keep a few nettles for the red admirals and the yellow admirals, lots of mulch. You know, when you pour that mulch up, there's all these things called litterhoppers, which are related to crabs and shrimps. And I never saw them in England, but they break down organic matter by the thousands. So we get many, many of those.
We get hoverflies
and goodness knows what.
Yeah. You've done a lot of research into biological control of pests on vineyards, adding plants to improve or increase the population of control agents. How's that going? Is that... just taken for granted now?
Well, I'll tell you what, we have one simple protocol, and that is scratching the seeds of another plant called buckwheat. You can buy buckwheat noodles in the supermarket, and that's in a completely different family, and the good insects go mad for the pollen of that flower. So many vineyards are putting in a few dollars worth of buckwheat seeds, one row in 10 in the vineyard. Actually, it costs about $2 for 100 metres, so it's ridiculously cheap. And the beneficial insects, especially wasps that sting the pests, go mad for that thing. And in the lab, if you give them water, they live for 3 days, these little wasps. If you give them buckwheat, they live for 43 days. It's
what? Seriously?
The right type of biodiversity in the right place, which is basically what we've been working on for donkey's years, is the way to go. And every New Zealand vineyard region, not vineyard, is using buckwheat in spring and summer. Lovely creamy white strips curving through the vineyard. I've got lots of photographs of it.
Wow. So you're making it sound like a real superfood. I mean, can I extrapolate to human beings from that?
Can you what, sorry?
Extrapolate, it's the word that I just...
Oh, sorry, yes, it's a good word, that, yeah. Well, put it this way, buckwheat also makes honey, but it's not very nice. Cecilia honey is delightful. But we're talking about sort of nature's services. We're using a pretty flower, the function of which we know. People stop their cars, they come out of the vineyard restaurant, take photographs, and we've actually quantified that people have said they're more likely to visit a particular vineyard again and buy the wine more often because they can see the growers actually doing something, to put it crudely, to help nature. And that's a lovely piece of social science related to biocontrol, really.
It is. It's very nice. But I want to know whether if buckwheat can increase the lifespan of an insect so yeah. much, will it increase mine?
Oh, crikey. Well, you could... I think if you ate buckwheat noodles, they don't have any gluten in them, so if some people are anti-gluten, that's ideal. For me, they have much better taste, and I think they're more nutritious than what is simply wheat flour, which is what most noodles are. So I do like buckwheat.
And you're 105, am I right?
Well, 103 and a half, actually.
Right, and doing well so far.
Yes, apparently, yes.
The research into pollens, then... is ongoing. You've got these three other pollens up at the University of Waikato being spectrometried.
Yes.
What other things are you looking forward to researching once the world writes itself?
Well, we're working on biocontrol in lots of regions. You know, classical biocontrol, people get an animal from another country,
yeah,
which eats a pet, eats an introduced pest, and they chuck it out, you know. But that's actually ridiculous, and since 1880, it's never been better than 10% successful. So that's an absolute waste of time. What we do is change the habitat in the farm to provide resources to the beneficial insects, the ones that are already in that farm, but in low numbers. It's like the wasp living 42 days. So back in Britain, we created a thing called beetle banks, which are actually in the Oxford English Dictionary now, and we put strips of tall grasses on banks across cereal fields, and in the winter all the good insects lived on there because it was warm and dry, and in the spring they emigrated into the field and ate pests. And beetle banks have been on BBC TV and goodness knows what else. So that was a lovely example of changing the landscape for a purpose, you know.
And can we do that here?
Well, I tried it actually, and they turned out being spider strips, not beetle banks, because the flipping things never left. They're so happy they stay in the flipping bank. So,
and we have less seasonality here. Would that make a difference?
That's very true. We did that work in southern England, and the winters can be really nippy, so the beetles did like staying there because it's dry and sheltered and has a few aphids living there. But here, there aren't enough of that type of beetle. They're called ground beetles, so we have them in our forests. We hardly ever see one in farmland, so we're wasting our time there when we did that.
And so do you think that we are more limited in terms of our biocontrol facilities?
Definitely. If you go into the middle of a wheat field here in the summer, whole families of insects, predator insects, are either absent or very low numbers, where one bloke I knew in England went into a barley field in summer. It was unsprayed, of course, and he found 700 species of beneficial insects. It's unbelievable. 700 species in one barley field.
So are you suggesting that we need to introduce more insects here?
Well, you can, and we are sometimes. Mm. People get very excited by that, because if the flipping thing goes wrong, I'll never get a job again.
Yeah, that's right.
So we have to be really cautious. We're doing it in glasshouses, actually, with great success for tomatoes, but... I wouldn't dream of doing it in open agriculture. I'll get locked up.
Well, you're locked up right now, so I wish you all the best.
Sleepy, yeah, that's true.
You go and take your cocker spaniel for a walk.
Yes, we do.
Very nice.
But only down the road.
Yes, of course, only locally. Absolutely. Very nice to talk to you. Thank you, Steve Ratton, Professor at Lincoln.